Henry Kissinger is often referred to as the consummate realist, so why does a new biography call him an idealist? Neil Ferguson will be here to talk about his new book, Kissinger.
The notion of him as the arch-realist who had modeled himself on 19th century figures like Metternich and Bismarck was way off.
How do you go from book publicist to best-selling essayist to debut novelist? Sloane Crossley will be here to talk about her first novel, The Clasp.
I knew that I wanted my book to be more than people sort of just sitting around whining about their lives in Brooklyn. I wanted them to get on a plane and get out of the house and go on a bit of a treasure hunt.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Neil Ferguson is here now. His most recent book is Kissinger, a long subtitle, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. Welcome, Neil.
Thanks for inviting me.
So this biography differs from the many previous biographies of Kissinger in a couple of key ways. The first being that not only is it an authorized biography, but as I understand it, Kissinger asked you to write the book.
Authorized implies that he had some kind of editorial control, which he didn't. It was his idea, but as I explain in the preface, I only agreed to do it on condition that I'd have a completely free hand. And on that basis, I had access to his private papers, was able to interview him. But I also did my due diligence in about 49 other archives for this volume, because the only way to write a book like this is to come at the subject from as many angles as you can. And that meant delving into foreign archives and trying to see how others saw him. So I'm a little nervous of that word, authorized, because it implies that you've written the official hagiography of Henry Kissinger, which this definitely isn't.
I'll give another A word, which is maybe a bit more neutral, but you did have extraordinary access because you're the first biographer to have been given access, full access, to his own personal papers.
Correct.
And how voluminous are those papers?
Pretty voluminous. I mean, if I try to tot up the number of documents that I looked at writing the book, and it's in the tens of thousands. Not all of those are from his private papers, but he did keep pretty extensive records of correspondence and diaries. For example, there's a remarkable diary of early trips to Vietnam in 1965 and 1966. There are, as you would expect from an academic, which after all he was for most of the first half of his life, lots and lots and lots of essays and papers that were never published and drafts of books. So it was really quite a task to get through it all. And as I was doing it, I realized that nobody who'd previously written about him had really engaged with the early writing, even the published stuff. And so the more I read, the more fascinated I became, because it wasn't at all what I'd expected. And you probably see that in the subtitle, which is a contrarian subtitle.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure we'll come to that. But it really hit me almost as soon as I started reading, almost on the first day when I went and looked at some of the stuff in his private home in Connecticut, that this was going to be a different story from the one I'd expected.
And you knew from the beginning that it was going to be a two-part biography.
Yes, I think I probably did. I'm not sure I entirely told my publisher that, but you know, these
things... Are they loath to publish a two-volume biography?
Oh, publishers hate multiple-volume biographies, but I'm somebody who rather likes them, and it's only by heroic act of self-restraint that I've agreed to keep it to two. This is a
you could
natural...
change your mind, you know. Bob Caro did that, I think, at some point.
I'm sure somebody's going to start comparing me with Bob Caro, but I'm not attempting anything on that scale or on the scale of Martin Gilbert's Churchill. Two volumes is about right. This is the first half of Kissinger's life chronologically. I mean, it goes right up to the halfway point.
And so he's 91
his life,
now?
92.
92.
So I basically take it up to the halfway point in his life, but it's also a natural break, the moment when he stops being an intellectual academic and enters the Nixon White House to become national security advisor. And I felt the smart thing would be to tell that much less well-known history of his intellectual development, explore where the ideas came from and what the intellectual achievement was. Write a book, really, that you could have written if Henry Kissinger had been hit by a bus in Washington in January 1969. If that had happened, he would still have been a substantial and important figure in the history of international relations or history.
There's a lot of Kissinger in here that I think many people who think a lot about those second 46 years, don't think about, I don't think most people, for example, think of him as a factory worker, which he was, and an infantryman who was drafted into the Army. Did you consciously go into it wanting to write about these periods of Kissinger's early life that people had sort of forgotten about?
Well, it's a pretty remarkable story, the story of a German Jewish refugee whose family leaves Germany just before the great pogrom known as Kristallnacht in 1938, who arrives with next to nothing in Manhattan, ends up in Washington Heights with a great many other refugees from Nazi Germany, and has to really claw his way up. I'm working in a shaving brush factory and then studying nights, aiming probably no higher than a decent career as an accountant. And then fate just doesn't stop raining down the blows. He's conscripted, drafted, and finds himself heading back to Germany in a U.S. Army uniform. That in itself is an amazing story. And I certainly found the letters he wrote back to his parents, 1944-45, from Germany, absolutely gripping.
Tell us a little bit about his wartime experiences.
Well, he was a grunt. I mean, he was a regular infantryman until they spotted that he had brains. And he was made a counterintelligence agent. And that was pretty lucky because he was involved in some pretty hair-raising combat at the Battle of the Bulge. Being counterintelligence was probably safer than being a rifleman. But it wasn't safe. And
right.
His account of being under heavy bombardment just a couple of miles away from the German troops at that point is pretty arresting. One realizes that he saw a lot more action than I think previous biographers had suggested. And then he becomes a Nazi hunter as the German regime collapses and stays on longer than I had expected. I mean, he actually opted to stay in occupied Germany down through to the summer of 1947, to his parents' great dismay. But as he explained, he felt that for the sake of his comrades who hadn't survived, he needed to do more to make sure that Germany was permanently stabilized. And this is expressed in one of those remarkable letters home that he wrote at that time.
You also interviewed Kissinger. How good was his recall? Did he remember writing about that period? Was this vivid to him? And how accurate were his memories versus what you were uncovering in the archives?
I'm the kind of historian who much prefers documents to interviews because memory can play you false. We did it in two stages. I interviewed him at the beginning thinking, this is an elderly man. I mustn't be overconfident. In fact, he probably will outlive me, judging by his robust health. But we did a lot of interviews at the beginning, which were actually very helpful in helping me to think about how I was going to approach it. But then we did a second round once I was writing, which was more along the lines of, is this right? Can I just ask you about this? And once you start interviewing that way, when you get much more detailed and when you can actually, I don't know, show a document to somebody, a document that they wrote many, many decades
before. To
say,
actually, you were wrong about you.
Yeah, well, you end up knowing a lot about the subject that the subject's forgotten. I was jogging his memory a lot with that material, and that was really helpful. I'd never done that before because previously I've written about the dead. That's what historians like to do.
Right.
They don't answer back and contradict you. But it was really fascinating to be able to write about somebody living and then be able to juxtapose what I'd found in the archives with his memory.
Well, the one question I have you finished your interviewing of him? Because I would think that there's a bit of a danger in publishing the first half and then saying, you know, now I'd like to interview you again. And, you know, him possibly saying, well, I have a quibble with what you wrote on page 736.
He would not be Henry Kissinger if he didn't have quibbles. He had plenty. But I've done all the interviewing for the second volume. I did it all in one great sweep. So I have tons
very
of material now on the Vietnam and on the key policy decisions of the Nixon and Ford years. So that's in the can, so to speak. But I still have a lot more research to do and a lot more documents to plow through before I can even begin writing volume two.
Do you think of this as a revisionist history of Kissinger?
Yes. I think I'm pretty sure that most previous accounts have got it wrong in arguing that he's the arch-realist. I was initially thinking of calling Volume 1 American Machiavelli. before I'd really got to work. And
then
I realized
that's the typical image of him.
Yeah, well, that's what we all kind of go into a project like this thinking. And I very quickly realized that this was quite wrong, and that the notion of him as the arch realist who had modeled himself on 19th century figures like Metternich and Bismarck was way off. On the contrary, as I started to read that early work, I realized he was, in fact, being critical of that realist or realpolitik strain in international relations, and was an idealist in more ways than one. I mean, he was an idealist in the strict sense that he read a lot of Kant at Harvard, immersed himself in idealist philosophy. But he was also an idealist in that he rejected all kinds of materialist interpretations of history, not only Marxism-Leninism, which was the ideology of the rival Soviet power bloc, but also the kind of materialist capitalist theories that were very fashionable when he was a graduate student and a junior professor. So he's an idealist in multiple ways. The obvious way in which he's an idealist comes out in his long and sometimes acrimonious relationship with the Kennedy administration. Now, we tend to think of Kennedy as an idealist because we remember his inaugural address.
Right.
But when you look at what Kennedy did in practice, he was a politician who cut deals, and he cut some pretty important deals over Berlin and over Cuba. Kissinger deplored these compromises in both cases because he felt that they compromised fundamental principles that the United States should be committed to, not least self-determination. And it was that belief that initially led him to support intervention in Vietnam. So I think he's been very badly misunderstood as a theorist. There's a whole set of issues that I still have to address about what he did in government that are not deliberately not addressed in this book. But I think one can say fairly clearly that the traditional view of Kissinger as the arch realist is wrong. And the guy who was actually the arch realist, Morgenthau, disagreed with Kissinger very publicly over the whole question of Vietnam, which seems like a pretty important piece of evidence. So the idealist as a subtitle will strike some readers of the New York Times as a provocation, and I'm sure it will make them spill their granola. But I think it's an absolutely legitimate argument. And if you read the book, and I do encourage people to read it before they comment, you'll see that it's actually a very compelling argument. He really thought of himself as an idealist and thought of Kennedy as a kind of grubby realist.
Obviously, there's going to be a lot more Vietnam in Volume 2, but you do write about Kissinger in Vietnam in a way that overturns some of the common current revisionist view of Kissinger's role there. What did you write in this book?
The conventional view is that Kissinger was so keen on the Vietnam War that he wanted it to go on for longer than was necessary. And this turns out to be very misleading. In common with most people who were thinking about the subject in late 1950s, early 1960s, Kissinger was inclined to think that the United States should act to keep South Vietnam going. But he began to have doubts much earlier than was common. And I was very startled to find this.
And this was you found in his diaries?
Right, in diaries and also in his advice to Nelson Rockefeller. He was close to Rockefeller, who had three unsuccessful bids for the Republican nomination to run for president. He advised Rockefeller to distance himself from Vietnam when Kennedy was still president. After the coup against the Diem government in Saigon, Kissinger's very negative about that. Then he goes to Vietnam in 1965 and is astonished by what he sees. And this is very nicely captured in the diary that he wrote for his own private use, I think. He identifies very quickly that the U.S. military doesn't understand the nature of the guerrilla war that they're fighting, mm-hmm. that Westmoreland and other senior military people have completely unrealistic ideas about how the war is going to be won. And he also realizes that there's something very rotten about the South Vietnamese state. So he comes back in 65, essentially saying, well, we either have to completely change the way we're fighting this war, or we need to have a negotiated diplomatic exit from it. And I was amazed to find how quickly he became involved in trying to find a diplomatic settlement. So in 1967, he's involved in this secret back channel attempt to get negotiations started with the North Vietnamese government. Mm-hmm. That's under Lyndon Johnson. and spends a great deal of time fruitlessly in Paris just trying to get a meeting with the North Vietnamese representative there. This doesn't sit easily with the idea of somebody who was enjoying the war so much he didn't want it to stop.
Right. Well, that leaves us very much in the middle of this story and in the middle of Kissinger's life. But that's the way you end it. So
it's a cliffhanger.
That's right. But before you go, just tell us what we can expect a little bit from Volume 2. I'm assuming you've already started working on it.
Well, I've done a lot of the research, though there's still more to do, partly because there are many, many more archives that I can go to. So it's probably doubly, if not triply, difficult. I haven't even begun to think through how I'm going to write it, what the subtitle will
be. I was going to say, you don't know what the subtitle is yet.
No, there's a sort of implicit cliffhanger. You might think, oh, well, he's going to turn into a realist once he has to sit down in the White House with Richard Nixon. But I'm not sure that necessarily will be the story. I think the big challenge for me is going to be to set out what the strategy was for both Nixon and Ford. Ford's years sometimes get forgotten by people who write about Kissinger, and to try to explain what they set out to do. This is prefigured in Volume 1, where we see the origins of the opening to China and some really remarkable and prescient things that are written then. But the challenge in Volume 2 is to say, well, here's what they set out to do.
Right.
Here were the priorities. Here was the hierarchy of priorities. Now let's try to understand all those very controversial episodes that people have written about, whether it's the bombing of Cambodia or the overthrow of Allende in Chile. Let's try to understand those episodes in the context of what was intended to be a grand strategy, not necessarily to win the Cold War, but to stabilize it, to avoid full-scale Third World War, also to extricate the United States from Vietnam, and at the same time to achieve breakthroughs, say, in the Middle East. I'm absolutely certain there was a coherent strategic framework. I think that's already in place at the end of Volume 1. The challenge in Volume 2 is going to be to show what happened when that theory, that framework, came into contact with events and realities.
Well, it'll be fascinating also to hear what Kissinger wrote about it in his diaries at the time. So look forward to your take on the second half of his life. Neil, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
The book, again, is Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist by Neil Ferguson. Alexandra Alter is here with an update from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Well, I have a little postscript to our conversation that we had last week about the Amy Schumer book deal. You were onto something when you said you thought she had been shopping around a book for a while or had already sold a book. In fact, after the news broke about her big book deal with Simon & Schuster,
which— This was the $8 to $10 million?
$8 to $10 million is the closest we could pin it down to. I got a couple of calls from people in publishing who said this was not the first time she'd sold a book. She'd actually sold a book to HarperCollins in 2013. It was a similar book of personal essays and worked with them on it for about a year. But said, you know, she got involved in the train wreck movie. Her show was taking off, and she said she was too busy to finish it. So she canceled that $1 million contract and returned the advance with interest, which proved to be rather smart on her part because now she has made much, much more. So that's the update on the Amy Schumer book. And other news in publishing, there's more literary awards landing, and we're seeing some critical consensus building early on in the award season. It looks like some of the favorites are Lauren Groff's The Fates and Furies. She was shortlisted for the Kirkus Prize this week, as was Ta-Nehisi Coates for Between the World and Me.
What is the Kirkus Prize? It's relatively new.
Yes, this is its second year, and it is a $50,000 prize in three categories: nonfiction, fiction, and young adult.
And how is it different from other awards? Do they look for something specific? Are the categories different? Or is it just another great award to win for underpaid writers?
I think it's another great award for underpaid writers. I mean, it's as these things go, it's a significant chunk of money. It's $50,000.
Not Amy Schumer level
pay grade.
It's
not Amy Schumer level. Nor is it a MacArthur Genius Grant, which also went out this week. That's a $500,000 payday. So that's pretty good. And there were three authors who made that list, including Ta-Nehisi Coates again. So he's now on the long list for the National Book Award. He's a finalist for a Kirkus Prize, and he's a MacArthur genius.
So and he's living in Paris right now.
Oh, too much. And another book that made the Kirkus list that has been getting a lot of critical attention is also longlisted for the National Book Award is A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. So I think, you know, those authors seem to stand a good chance of winning at least one of the several awards that they're nominated for.
And we should say Hanya is a New York Times staffer. She is the deputy editor of T Magazine.
And shortlisted for the Booker.
So the MacArthur Genius Awards, I think that's a kind of a household name, but people outside of publishing, I'm not sure that they necessarily know what Kirkus is.
Right. So Kirkus is, Kirkus Reviews does a lot of book reviews.
It's a trade publication.
Exactly.
Like Publishers Weekly.
Yes.
And they come out with their sort of short reviews before the books actually.
Exactly. And they were actually long known for being a little sharper elbowed than a lot of the other trade publications.
But now they're being nice and giving out
lots
of money.
And handing out tens of thousands of dollars to authors, so I'm sure authors are thrilled.
And when do we find out who the winners are?
That'll be announced on October 15th.
All right.
So October is going to be a big month because the Nobels are coming out as well as the Booker. So you'll
and the National Book Awards,
it.
We have to wait until November.
That's right.
But we'll be talking about them more soon. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Sloane Crosley is here now. She has a new novel out, The Clasp, which is reviewed this week by Julia Pierpont. Hi, Sloane.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So this is your first novel. Did you always want to write a novel?
I did always want to write a novel. I mean, the essays weren't just a temporary distraction. I did those on purpose as well. But I wrote a terrible novel right when I graduated from college, which will never see the light of day. So that was round one. And this for public is round two.
Before this, you had two collections of essays. The first, I was told there would be cake. And how did you get this number? We were just talking about the fact that it has no question mark. Why does it have no question mark?
I thought it was a little bratty to have a question mark because it's an inherently sort of confrontational statement. And so I hacked it off. It's so interesting how people get finicky about titles. And I think for I Was Told There'd Be Cake, people really warmed to that title. And I wanted to separate the novel out. So that's why it has two words, one of which is the. So very simple.
And you're a former book publicist.
Yes.
So tell us about your book publicist, your pre-life.
My pre-life actually, it wasn't so delineated as pre and post. I wrote the first two books while I was still working as, I don't remember what my last title was, a deputy director of publicity. Does that sound correct?
Mm-hmm.
At Vintage Books. And I was there for about 10 years, but I published the first two books while I was there. So I took all my vacation to go on book tour. I mean, I loved book publicity, but I was really burning the candle at both ends. So I quit actually to write The Clasp.
The Clasp takes its title or its central idea from a story by Guy de Maupassant. Tell us about The Necklace.
I was going to answer you in French, but it's a little early for me to fake a French accent.
Should we do our over? I'm guilty of always overpronouncing my French accent.
Right.
So,
Guy de Maupassant.
Let's bring it back down to earth.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us about The Necklace. What's the story?
It's a very famous short story. It's probably somewhere.
What you're saying is we should feel bad if we don't know about it.
It's just, well, it's somewhere in your house right now, probably, if you own a short story anthology. You shouldn't feel bad, but you should know that it's probably wedged somewhere between Cathedral and, you know, a vintage Thunderbird. It doesn't get a lot of credit, or it doesn't get the credit it deserves, because it's sort of this fable kind of story. And it's very simple, and it's very clean. And it's actually very complex and very depressing. And I started looking into the story as inspiration for these characters. And I was struck by how modern it was and how their problems seemed so contemporary when it came to love and class and social issues. And of course, it all revolved around a necklace, an actual piece of jewelry. And I knew that I wanted my book to be more than people sort of just sitting around whining about their lives in Brooklyn. I wanted them to get on a plane and get out of the house and go on a bit of a treasure hunt. So it's perfect for me.
What was the story in The Necklace?
Oh, the story is basically about a woman who's on the cusp of being part of French society. And so her husband procures her an invitation to a very fancy party. And instead of being happy, she's distraught because she has no jewelry to wear, which at the time is actually truly something that was very important.
It also sounds like the subject of one of your earlier essays, even though it wasn't. But it could have been.
It could have been. Hopefully I would have had a better reaction if someone invited me somewhere. But basically, she borrows a necklace from a very wealthy friend of hers. Mm-hmm. And she has the night of her life, comes home, reaches for her neck, and realizes that she's lost it. So they can't find the necklace. They replace it, the poor couple. Mm-hmm. They replace it, but they beg, borrow, and steal and mortgage their entire lives to do it. And then basically she falls into ruin and runs into the rich woman at the very end of the story. She's running and she's in a park with her, and I'll ruin the ending because it is a fairly famous story. And the woman says, "Oh my gosh, you look so terrible. What happened?" And she tells the whole story I just told you. And the woman says, "Oh my dear, it was fake. It was paste." And it was viewed as quite tragic in France at the time. I think our tragedy bars have changed in terms of what's genuinely upsetting and what's not.
Right.
But it was very upsetting when it was published. And it was, of course, published on the front page of the newspaper, which, if you can imagine a short story being published on the front page of a newspaper.
I don't think that's going to happen
I don't
in
think
today's
so either.
media landscape. When did you first read that story?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because it's the one thing that I sort of cringe at slightly with the CLASP, where I think I probably read that in eighth or ninth grade. Mm-hmm. The characters in the book read it in college. But they're very smart. I don't think they go to a remedial college. So it's a little bit of a factual inaccuracy. But I read it when I was younger. It's not even my favorite short story. I just really thought it was a great sort of beautiful coat hanger, I guess, to hang my plot on.
Did you always know that you wanted to go back to that story? Did the novel start with that story?
The novel started with really some character sketches. And like I said, I was working at Vintage at my old job. And so it was really difficult to fully immerse myself in this world of these characters and what they wanted and what their sort of central conflict was going to be. I was sort of struggling a little bit because I had them, but they weren't really congealing into a novel, you know? And you know,
yes.
You read enough of these things and you know what it looks like when someone's just, you know, doing a 12-page description of an oak tree and when it doesn't have a heartbeat to it and it doesn't have a structure to it. And I just needed some inspiration. I was in my apartment one night and I pulled down this anthology and I read it. I just didn't remember it being so sad or so true. And it seemed like all
Maybe
of my characters—
Maybe it still is a tragedy then.
It still is a tragedy. I mean, to waste your life is a tragedy. And that's actually what all these characters are
concerned. In
pursuit
of a misconception.
Yes, in pursuit of either a misconception or thinking you want something that it turns out you very much do not want.
Who are the characters that were in your mind looking for a plot?
There's three essential characters. There's Victor, who was recently fired from the internet's seventh largest search engine for pitching a hipster search engine, which will get you fired quite quickly from an environment like that. There's Kezia, who is actually named after a Catherine Mansfield short story. There's all sorts of Easter eggs for short story lovers within the novel. And she works for an independent jewelry designer who's sort of a madwoman. And then there is Nathaniel, who has this sort of Fitzgeraldian dream of making it and selling his wares in LA and has about as much success, actually.
So you've alluded to short stories a few times. Did you think about, you've written essays, obviously, you're used to the short form. Did you think about writing a collection of short stories or, you know, intersecting stories, or did you know you wanted to write a novel?
I did think about it, but, you know, when you write in one form for so long, I think that not everyone has this reaction, clearly. Some people move pretty fluidly from short stories to sort of the neighbor of the novel, whereas I traveled quite far from essays into a novel. But I think it was sort of reactive. It was, I want something very different. I mean, two-thirds of this book is told from the male perspective. It's in the third person. There's an adventure. It takes place in more locations than New York. And I think I just want it out a little bit. And now, of course, I kind of want back in, you know, to the comfort of essays. I'm looking forward to writing those next.
Do you think of yourself as still like Sloane Crosley, comic essayist? Or are you now thinking of yourself as a novelist?
It's funny. People just put labels on that are actually, for the most part, complimentary. I remember when the first book came out, when I was told the BK came out, it said humor / essays on the back of the book. And I thought, oh, humor. It's just inherently funny. That's very nice of them, but it's really just sort of a categorization for how it's shelved. So it doesn't have anything to do with
the reality of the Barnes & Noble categories.
Well, it hadn't occurred to me I was writing humor essays when I wrote that book.
You meant them all very seriously.
Very seriously.
People just misinterpreted.
People, I wish they would stop laughing at me. It's humiliating. No, but I mean, I think the tone, that's what transferred over to the CLASP, is the tone of the essays. And there's hindrances to writing narrative nonfiction. And it was nice to have those breaks taken off for fiction.
So going back to labeling you, does your inner publicist from your 10 years as a book publicist, did you like have a voice inside you kind of responding to what you were doing in the novel?
Well, there's a consciousness that it will be published. I mean, that's what happens when you have a book contract, which is really the best thing for you. It's very motivating. I mean, when I quit my job, I told the New York Times in a small piece they did that I would be writing a novel when I hadn't started it yet. People have different some people keep it a secret. Mine, I'm very motivated by fear. So
once you'd said it in public, then you
once
had
I said
to
it in public,
it.
I was really responsible to go ahead and do it. But similarly, I think that I know that there's a perception or a label out there, but I can never quite figure it. Just when I think I have a handle on it, it turns out to be something else, or people review the book differently or treat it differently. And it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, as long as they enjoy it.
Well, your inner publicist probably knew you'd be doing this podcast one day.
My inner publicist crossed my fingers, because I think if you guys had trashed the book,
I would not have been here.
It might make for a really colorful interview.
We try not to do that. So are you working on another novel, or are you going back to essays?
I have an idea for another novel, but my next book is going to be essays. So most of those, I'm about halfway through those. But it is interesting to switch gears and bring it back to myself, and to also not be able, you can bend what happened, but you can't just sort of fabricate it whole cloth and say, oh, okay, well, now it takes place in Miami.
Right. So. Well, you're now multi-hyphenate, former book publicist / essayist / novelist and occasional reviewer and essayist for us. Sloan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The novel, again, is The Clasp by Sloan Crossley. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Let's start with the nonfiction list, which is where most of the action is this week. Down at number 15, the journalist David Marinus has a new book called Once in a Great City. It's a look back at Detroit, specifically in 1963, which you would think of as boom times in Detroit, but he traces the city's decline to that year. It's kind of the year that everything changed for Detroit, heralding what it is now.
Let me go from north to south.
Yes. So it's My Southern Journey, new at number 14, by the former New York Times reporter and now Southern Living columnist Rick Bragg. And this book, My Southern Journey, collects a lot of those columns. It's just kind of mini essays about Southern living, about the South as Rick Bragg knows it. Then there's a new book at number 9 this week. The historian Jay Winnick has a book called 1944. It's a look at the decisions that FDR made in 1944. That of course, is the year of D-Day. It's partly a look at how 1944 turned the tide of the war in the Allies' favor, but it's also hugely an indictment of FDR's policies toward the Holocaust. It says that Roosevelt could have really done a lot more to save the European Jews and chose not to because he thought it would interfere with his bigger policy, his bigger strategy of winning the war against the Nazis.
A number of books recently going back and forth on that question.
Indeed. And Winnick's book quite knowingly borrows from some of the arguments that Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman made in FDR and the Jews a couple of years ago. Then up at number 3, the blogger and memoirist Jenny Lawson has her second memoir to hit the list. It's called Furiously Happy. It is a comic look at her history of mental illness. She's struggled with clinical depression and anxiety attacks and panic attacks. So this is kind of taking readers through her history of that. And then finally, new at number 1 this week, Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard are back with the next book in their Killing series. It's called Killing Reagan. It's about the modern-day Republican Party. No, I'm kidding. It's really about the attempt on Reagan's life in 1981, the John Hinckley attack.
You've been covering this series that O'Reilly has been working on for the last few years. Who do you think will be next in the Killing lineup?
Well, this book marks kind of a departure in the series because it's not an actual killing, but an attempted killing.
Well, that opens the field then.
Exactly right.
What's on fiction?
On fiction, there's just one new title. It is all the way at the very top of the list, a new number one. Jan Karen continues her Mitford series, set in Mitford, North Carolina, with a book called Come Rain or Come Shine.
Well, that's actually quite an accomplishment because there's some heavy hitters on the fiction side that are now knocked down a notch, including The Newly Child, The New Girl in the Spider's Web, Go Set a Watchman, The Girl on the Train.
Anthony Doerr. All of those people have had their turn at number one. Lee Child was number one last week. But yes, Jan Karen comes in and knocks them all down.
But there's some more action over on the children's book list.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot on the hardcover adult fiction list this week. But kids, there are some books. On the middle grade hardcover, Ali Benjamin has a book called The Thing About Jellyfish that was long listed for the National Book Awards.
It's a debut novel.
It is a debut novel about grief. It's about a seventh grade girl whose friend drowns, and she becomes convinced that it wasn't a drowning, that it was actually the result of a rare jellyfish sting. So that book is new at number 10 on the middle grade hardcover list.
It's also a book about a very au courant subject, which is bullying and the transition of a girl from elementary school to middle school and how hard that can be.
How disruptive socially.
Yes.
And, it also brings quite a lot of science in. The girl in question kind of travels the world looking to prove her theory, and it brings in a lot of kind of oceanography and marine biology as
right.
well.
It's about adaptation, both animal adaptation and human.
And another book about animal and human adaptation, new on the middle grade hardcover list. At number four, Catherine Applegate, who pretty much staked out her own territory on the middle grade list for weeks and weeks and over a year with The One and Only Ivan. She has her first new novel since The One and Only Ivan. It's called Crenshaw. And it's about a boy and his imaginary friend who happens to be a giant cat as the boy's family comes on hard times.
If I have an imaginary friend, I think I would take a gigantic cat.
Who surfs.
Well, okay. Maybe not a surfing cat. Anything else going on the kids' lists?
Yeah, in the young adult hardcover list, Neil Gaiman has a new book, The Sleeper and the Spindle is new at number one. And there's also a new number two book on that list. It's by Ray Carson. It's called Walk on Earth, a Stranger. And then finally on the series list, the third title, I think, in the Miss Peregrine series, Miss Peregrine's Peculiar Children by Ransom Riggs is new right at number one.
Well, it's October, so it must be dark and spooky storytelling time.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Greg. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.